Frank Gennaro!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
We stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Here it is, another Brock and Salk podcast. Hi, Brock. How are we doing?
I'm doing well, Michael. How are you doing? You have a great Father's Day weekend?
It was nice. It's nice to be with my lovely ladies in my life. Yeah, we had a great time. Father's Day's cool. It doesn't have quite the same importance as Mother's Day.
No. It should not.
Right. I mean, it's sort of, and the fact that it comes like a month later kind of makes it even less important. It's just sort of like this little tack
on. It's like a hat tip.
Yeah. It's like, and we've added Father's Day. Like, you know, you shower your wife or mom with gifts. Then it's dad's turn. It's like, eh, we got you some golf tees. So it's just like, it doesn't have the same energy behind it, right? There's no brunch tradition. Usually dad is out there cooking, you know, grilling or something. It just, it's a little different. That's all.
True.
It's fun, though.
But still really nice
to be
celebrated.
Supposed to be U.S. Open Sunday, which is always kind of nice.
That's
but
true.
No, it wasn't.
It was RBC Heritage Open Sunday. A lot of guys right by the leaderboard.
Packed leaderboard.
How about Bernard? No, I don't want to get too into golf now, but how about Bernard Langer?
It is a podcast. We can skip forward as far as they want to go.
How about?
All right, this is golf. It'll be about 2.5 minutes.
And we can fast forward.
That's true.
We're going to start senior tour. We're going to go Corn Ferry. We'll wrap up PGA.
If you're not interested in golf, fast forward 2 minutes right now. How about that dude making the cut? He was 62?
Oh, that was the RBC?
Yes.
I saw Longer on the green, and I was like, oh, this is senior, I'm out. Are
he
they
made
playing
the
right
cut.
Now? Is this a replay?
Made the cut.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Bernard Longer. He's
I
man.
Know.
He's the king of the seniors.
Jordan made the cut, too. Don't worry, Brock. Jordan made the cut.
Oh, did he?
He was in first place for a little while.
He was.
Early.
Good day.
You know?
On Thursday. Things kind of got away from him after that. We'll come back to him a little bit later. All right. Years ago, Brock, many, many, many moons ago, I made some people angry in this town by suggesting that Ken Griffey Jr. at age like 50 or whatever he was at the time and hitting like a buck 12 should be benched.
Put him on the bench.
People weren't happy about it. They
Michael.
Reminded me that Ken Griffey Jr. was a legend in this town, that I had been here for like 3 months, and that maybe I should shut
definitive
my
statement.
Hole.
I think the Mariners should sit Ken Griffey Jr., not just against lefties. The Mariners should sit him. He should change his role. He should no longer be the primary DH. I'm not talking about dropping him down from third or fourth to sixth or seventh. The Mariners should sit Ken Griffey Jr. They should put him on the bench.
He was batting third or fourth.
You I mean, opened it's... the show that day.
Yeah.
I think...
Here I am. Hello. Hello.
Here's your legend and king. I will put him on the bench. Good morning. Listen to the rest of the show.
I am pretty confident that was in June. I'm pretty confident that I was in Hawaii.
You were
on
your pre-Titus vacation.
Pretty confident that Damon Huard was on the show with
true.
You that day.
Yep.
Pretty confident that after you called me after the show and we were chatting, I was on a beach, and I still picture the family that was sitting on the beach as you were sharing with me what you did that day to try to sabotage our very own Brock and Salk show.
See, that's not right. I didn't try to sabotage.
I think that's the first time I had to remind you, Mike, we are in this together. This isn't the Salk declarative statement show.
First time of many that you had to remind me of.
Saboteur.
Now, let's be clear. Before you just, you know, kill me for this, let's remember that night, and if you continue to play that clip, you'll hear me say that he should come off the bench, he should pinch hit, he should continue to be, you know, a part of the team, just not starting every day.
Why would we want to hear any of that?
Well, if you were to keep listening, that's what you would hear. Later that night, Ken Griffey Jr. did not start the game, and he was benched, at least for that night. They put
I mean,
him
you
on
had Don
bench.
Wakamatsu's ear. Let's be very
Walk
clear.
And I were very close.
Yes.
You may remember that later that night, a game, I want to say against Texas, but I'm not sure. I think it was against Texas. The Mariners had a chance to come back late in the game, and Ken Griffey Jr., who had been on the bench, was brought in to do what he should have been doing all along, pinch hit. And this is what happened.
The fans hoping to catch a little bit of the old-time religion right here, baby, with Junior stepping up to the plate. Here comes the stretch. And the pitch to Junior on the way. Swing and a fly ball hit to deep right center field. That baby is going to be fly away. The old-time religion lives. Junior does it. A two-run home run. And we are tied at 3-3. My, oh, my. Magic is back at least for a night.
And I just remember thinking to myself, yep, got it right.
Nailed it.
Nailed it.
Bingo. Coming in the next morning to receive your applause.
All right, everybody, bow to your new king. Ken Griffey Jr. is the old king. Now I shall be your new one.
And if I remember correctly, didn't Dave Niehaus call you on his drive home and say, thanks, Mike, for allowing them?
I just remember the weeks we had to call him the Oracle after that.
You weren't even here yet. Long live the king. The king is dead. Long live the king. Yes.
The king has no clothes.
All right. That is how that night ended. So please keep that in the back of your mind as we go through a couple of other conversations spurred on by the Junior documentary this weekend, and then a bit of the conversation that I had with Tom, Jake, and Stacey yesterday.
Why do you feel the need to qualify? You're making me nervous now. Now keep that in the back of your mind as I take you now on this journey.
All right, two questions. One was the one that Tom asked me yesterday, Brock. And that is Ken Griffey Jr. still the most important athlete or the most significant athlete in Seattle history?
Yes. I would just simply say the greatest athlete. I don't know how else to, sports is simple, keep it simple, stupid. So renowned, significant, remembered. I'll just say the greatest. Was he the greatest? Is he still to this day the greatest athlete to perform in his sport in this market? I would say yes.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Russ. And I'm going to kick you out of the Church of Wilsonism if that's your answer. Sacrilege. Sacrilege to the high priest.
I'm going to use something that the oracle once said to me, and that is there's nothing like the first. It doesn't matter how many Super Bowls you went after. It doesn't matter what you accomplished. There's nothing like that initial ride. There's nothing like that first. And there's nothing like your first superstar, especially in the Pacific Northwest, in South Alaska at that time, where you're not connected socially, where you do not have the connections globally, where you do not have what you have today. And that guy shook the entire sports world. That guy's ability was off the charts. The kid was the superstar of superstars, and he helped save the sport. The Seattle Mariners exist today because of his presence in this town. Did he win a World Series like Russ has won a Super Bowl? No. But did he reverberate in a way around the country and in the sporting world that Russell never has?
Well, he certainly did that. There's no doubt. I mean, the national view of Ken Griffey Jr., obviously, I mean, he was... Kyle was saying earlier, what, second after Jordan during that era, or certainly in that conversation? It's kind of pre-Tiger. So,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, it throughout the 90s, I think you would put him sort of right after Ken Griffey Jr. in terms of, or right after Jordan, rather, in terms of the biggest sports names on the planet. I'll still take Russ. I'll take Russ because of some of the things you just said. Russ does come along as Seattle enters a new era, as Seattle does become an international hub, as it becomes a tech capital, as everything kind of explodes around him. Russell Wilson is right there at the front of all of it and kind of rides that wave. By the way, actually wins a championship, goes to the playoffs every single year but one of his career, in which he missed by a game. I mean, that there is something to that, and plays the most important position, the most interesting position in all of sports, and does it in a way that is fairly unique. That's not to say there haven't been people who combine running and throwing the way he has, but I would say that for all of them, he was the first to really throw with that kind of accuracy.
Yeah.
And be able to run and kind of do it. The balance of being pass first with that ability to run, I think, was unique. And look what it has opened up in his sport afterwards. Whether Russell gets credit for it or not, look at the preponderance of athletic quarterbacks you now find all the way throughout the league, so much so that it is the norm rather than the exception. That's the significance of what Russell was. You could talk about Ken Griffey Jr.'s significance in the media and in the scene and to saving baseball in Seattle, all enormously important. And this is not a one is great, the other is lousy conversation. This is 1A and 1B, and you're arguing over the last little bit that tips the scales. But I'm going to argue what Russell has done to change the game of football is much more significant than what Ken Griffey Jr. did to change the game of baseball. Heck, the game changed around him and not because of him, as half the guys started injecting all kinds of stuff into their body and blowing up like balloons. And all of a sudden, he gets passed by Barry Bonds and the Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa chase and all of that. You can take a look at Ken Griffey's influence. Afterwards, it's not that high, which is odd considering how great he was. But these other guys decided to cheat and take over the mantle of the sport pretty quickly. So I don't know. I'm going to go with Russ.
Kyle and Howdy.
I think that this is we're finally entering a period where we're allowed to have this conversation. And it's a reasonable one. Like, it's reasonable now to talk about, will Russell Wilson ever clip Ken Griffey Jr. in the Seattle sports scene? When we're talking about the most important Seattle sports athlete, there will be a time where I think he gets to that conversation, and we're just entering it now, but I think it's still definitively Ken Griffey Jr. Definitively the most important Seattle sports figure in Seattle history. Absolutely.
Yeah, we talked about some of this yesterday, and there is something about your youth that you can never shake.
Correct.
And so exactly I do understand there are going to be a group of
people. You're going to rattle my childhood and tell me that it wasn't great.
I understand.
If you're going to tell me it's not great.
You can tell me that there are better outside linebackers and sack artists than Lawrence Taylor.
Yeah.
And you might be right, but I'll never admit it.
No. There's no better point guard than Magic Johnson. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, I don't.
No. Yes. No, you're wrong.
He's still the greatest Laker of
you're
all time. I don't
yourself.
Care what else happens. I'll take him over Kobe. That's just how it is. And so I understand that there will be an element of that for a lot of folks. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think if you were to really look at it fully objectively and consider all of the youngsters who don't even, you know, they never saw Ken Griffey Jr. here. What was his last year here in Seattle? The first time was 1999.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, think about how many people, for them, that's nothing. All of the millennials born essentially after that. So I'm going to go with Russell Wilson, and he plays the biggest sport on the planet. He plays the most important position in that sport, and by far the most interesting and important position in all of sports, and leads his team to a championship, another Super Bowl, all those playoff appearances in this town with the fans going wild and all of that. Yeah, I'm going to take Russ.
Very challenging when you're never the superstar on your own team. And that's not his fault. That's the makeup of that team. That was the makeup of Pete being a defensive-minded coach. That's the makeup of Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas and the whole rest of that defense that was loud, that was vocal, that was brash, that it was the nature of Marshawn Lynch. That in some way you look at, you know, the years that they share together, and you take a survey of people in this town and say, you know, 2016, hey, who is a bigger star, Marshawn or Russell? I think even in this town, people would say, oh, that was Marshawn. I mean, Russell's awesome, but Marshawn is the star, man. Marshawn's our guy. Marshawn's the identity of this team.
Yeah, but over time, that dissipates. I mean, I think you could have said that at the moment because I don't think we fully recognized what kind of a big deal Russell was. But over time, as he
then he's got to win another one, right?
Right. Yes. Absolutely.
Then he's got to win another one.
That's why I think this conversation is just getting started. I don't think he's there yet because he wasn't even considered the reason why they won that. And it was years until we even recognized and said, you know what? Without Russell Wilson, that doesn't really happen.
I mean, but it is true. But in retrospect, without Russell Wilson, they don't come close to that. I don't care what Richard says or whether Doug thinks somebody else would have placed him the ball in a better spot every time. Russell is absolutely the reason that happens. And go back to watch some of those games. I know there are a couple of rough ones early, but once that Chicago game happened, the New England game happened, I mean, Russell Wilson in 2012 really starts to take over and do so much more. And by 2013, it's not even a question.
Malcolm Butler also enters this conversation, too.
Obviously.
Literally, he threw the pass that cost them the most embarrassing loss in Super Bowl history. Like, that's going to be a factor when you're talking about legacy, when you're talking about greatest ever.
It's
going
not.
To factor into
it's
it.
Not going to.
It does for me.
Really?
Absolutely.
You, of all people, you who blames Daryl Bevel?
We're talking about looking in the backwards mirror to say, what is your legacy?
You can't.
That's a moment you'll never be able to
disassociate. Then that leads to conversation, too. If that's where you want to go with it, then unfortunately, I've got to bring up the next part of the Ken Griffey Jr. conversation, which is going to be even harder for some people to handle, and I understand that. But
where was I supposed to have Griffey in the back of my mind? Is he still there? Or
he's
is it
still on the bench, Brock. He's sitting on the bench.
He's getting ready to come in and pinch hit for his big home run.
Okay.
Jr. made 3 playoff appearances in his Seattle career. 3. And I hear a lot of complaints, say, well, you know, they never put enough around him, and I blame management and this and that. And I'm sure there is a lot of logic and accuracy to that. They probably should have done
three Hall of Famers around him, and A-Rod, Randy Johnson, Edgar Martinez.
Yeah, I mean, there were some people around him. Junior made three playoff appearances in his time in Seattle. If you think that it was just Seattle's fault that he never made the playoffs, in his career in Cincinnati from 2000 through the middle of 2008, he made a grand total of zero playoff appearances.
No, they didn't put anything around him.
At the very end of his career, he made one more where he was traded to the White Sox on July 31st. They were already in first place that day. They went on to make the playoffs and lose 3-1 in a five-game series to the Tampa Bay Rays in 2008.
That's a good Rays team, yeah.
So I at least think there is a question about whether or not he deserves some of the credit/blame for only making three playoff appearances in his career. It's certainly not because of the numbers. The numbers are spectacular. The guy is one of the greatest players of all time and nearly a unanimous choice as a Hall of Famer. So they're on the first ballot. So no, this is not a crack on Ken Griffey Jr., the player, or his credentials. But it does become one of these questions of why didn't his teams win that much?
The caveat in Cincinnati, though, is he played 1 year. Like, he never played. He played more than 100 games twice in his time in Cincinnati.
From 1976 to 95.
That's just actually incorrect.
He played.
How do you wrong?
Your first 2 years, he played 145, 111.
Yeah, then he was hurt for 3 years. Then 128, 109, 144, 102.
When he was 35, 36, 37, 38, he's well beyond his prime.
Howdy.
Well beyond his prime.
Howdy.
Tell me more 35 to 38
after 35
year olds are supposed to be the ones
you build
your team around.
Howdy. The guy, but you can't just, you're just deadly inaccurate with what you just said.
2 years of his prime that he played over 100 games in that place. That's not even two-thirds of the season.
128, 109, 144, 102. What are you talking
35,
about?
35, 36,
it was
37.
Six times.
Erroneous, irrelevant.
Six times.
Erroneous.
That was the case. Six times.
From 1976 to 1994. What were the Seattle Mariners?
Laughing stock?
They were the laughing stock of laughing stocks.
I mean, the first year they hit 500, they like celebrated, it was, I think, in the clubhouse in Texas. In, like,
remember what you said about the New England Patriots of your youth?
Laughing stock.
I mean, joke show. Yep. Like, don't even belong. These Mariners are playing T-ball. I remember like some of the, like, this was just, they're so bad. And then they get the kid. And then things change from 95 till, when did he leave? 99? And then obviously they go on the run after him and what he's built and built Safeco Field. And then what's it been like the last 18, 19 years?
It's a really good point. It's why Drew Bledsoe is considered the greatest player in Patriots history.
Excuse me.
He turned it all around. Before Bledsoe, they were a complete joke show. And that's why Drew Bledsoe is considered to be the greatest Patriots player who ever lived.
Well, the Mariners won six World Series titles after Griffey left. And now Griffey's legacy cemented. But the other factor that you said when Griffey left in 99 is that he forced his way out of town. He said he didn't want to play in Seattle anymore. He made the Mariners trade him back to Cincinnati.
Russell hasn't done that.
Yet. You know, they haven't done that yet. Now, Colin Cowherd would like us to believe he's tried. It hasn't succeeded yet. But if you want to talk about your legacy in Seattle, Griffey said in his prime, I don't want to be here.
All right, let me ask it this way then. Ken Griffey Jr. is not responsible for his teams not making the playoffs all those years. I'm not going to come close to saying that. But is his personality, is there something about his leadership, is there any connection between the lack of playoff appearances and him in some way?
It's hard in baseball, man.
Then Derek Jeter, then stop talking about how great Derek Jeter is.
Okay, done.
Forever.
Fine, I'm all in on that.
Forever,
yeah,
everybody else.
Yes.
Don't talk about what a great leader Jeter, I mean, it has to end. Guy was also, I mean.
Are you trying to pull the Bob Stelton? You can't have it both ways.
You can't. You can't have this one both ways. You can't tell me that Derek Jeter was the perfect leader on this
captain,
and that.
Right?
He was the captain, the perfect
number
captain. If there's something about his leadership ability when your best player is also your hardest worker and all that, you can't have it that way and then also tell me that Ken Griffey Jr. doesn't have some level of responsibility for not leading his team to multiple playoff appearances year after year and eventually reaching a championship. He had really good players around him during that time, just like Jeter did. Jeters were better, obviously, but he had really good players around him. He has Buehner. He has Edgar. He's got Randy Johnson. I mean, there's a bunch of good players, eventually A-Rod. I mean, like, there's some good players that are around him. It didn't get, they never made it over the top. And did he underperform? No. But how many times have we talked about your best player being the hardest worker and what it does for your team? And I don't think anyone has ever said Ken Griffey Jr. was the hardest worker. He was so naturally talented that he didn't have to do that. He's the most talented athlete maybe who's ever played the game.
Yeah, but I would just think the litmus test there would also be your teammates, right? And those guys seem to love
him.
They
love him. Absolutely. You're
right. I mean,
from the time he was 19 years old.
100%.
Run into walls, play through injuries. Some of the people say part of the problem he broke down so fast is he played day after day and on that turf and on that cement and into those walls. And just so I think it maybe the get up at 5 a.m. and leave at 9 p.m. was not his deal. But what was his deal was being a baseball player every single day. And his teammates just loved him for that.
100% true. And it's a great, great argument in his favor. So you think it's just that there wasn't enough talent around him?
They had one pitcher on their entire rotation and bullpen. That's it, Randy Johnson. One during the 90s.
Whoa, remember Andy Benes?
Remember
take a seat, old man Bazio, the first edition of El Guapo. No thanks.
Remember, Salk, Randy Johnson started the game, and then he went and put ice on himself in the dugout.
Thanks, Don.
And then he came back. And then he was Willis Reed.
He came back into that game. That was a big moment for him. I mean, they had Jamie Moyer for a bunch of those years. I hear a lot about how great Jamie Moyer was.
Yeah, in the 2000s.
Okay, well, I hear a lot about Jamie Moyer, and he was on the... I mean, look, I don't know. You guys are probably right. Maybe it has nothing to do with it, but then by all means, feel free to start discrediting Derek Jeter. All the time.
Thank you.
Okay, do you have a third option here? We knocked down
this
one
whole
and two.
Thing was angling towards Salk discrediting Jeter. This was just a big setup for him to get everyone to agree that we no longer respect Derek Jeter.
Can we all agree on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Done.
Brock?
I'm all in.
Can you agree that we can no longer respect Derek Jeter?
No, I'm not going to go there. Well, then, but his post-playing days are pretty atrocious.
What about his playing days? Refusing to move from shortstop. Oh, A-Rod's here and he's better, but I'm not moving. I'm the captain.
Can't do it.
No, did I'm you here. Have a third part of this, by
what?
The way? That
no.
We're gonna get... No?
This was just these two parts.
Oh, okay, good.
Why? did you walk
did
me?
You?
Also...
Are you not satisfied?
Do you need me to say something more inflammatory?
Are you not entertained?
Jeez. You trying to egg me on?
No. No, I just want to make sure you told me to put it on the back burner. I have it in the back of my mind. And so we're kind of, I'm a lineal guy. I like processing things.
I was putting it on the back burner that I had been right about Junior all those years ago.
Oh, okay.
So now as we have this conversation, it's a chance to be open-minded about who he is. And who
no,
he is.
No, I mean,
is
he was difficult. I mean, I think that, you know, I can applaud him because it was most important to him to be loved by his peers. That is kind of that baseball ethos and creed is, you know, you want to be loved in that dugout, not by the managers, not by the general managers, not the fans, not any of that stuff. He just commanded and wanted that respect. So yeah, it was difficult as a fan when he just drove off, right? When he left us in 99, he wanted to go to his hometown and everybody said, okay, I guess so. Hey, you know, we love you and you save baseball here and we'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
A little forgiving of Ken Griffey Jr. here in his career. When he fell asleep in the clubhouse and then drove off home. 2 days
got
later.
Got in a car, didn't talk to anyone, drove. So he had to find him somewhere.
And that's part of the folklore.
Everyone else like, darn right.
And then he drove
good
to
him.
Darn right. Seen at a gas station in Missoula, Montana. And that's part of the legacy.
Way to go, Junior.
He did it my way, like Frank Sinatra.
Right. When he does it, he did it my way, like Frank Sinatra. When Milton Bradley does it, he's crazy.
Oh, get that guy out of here. What do you think he is?
And for good reason. So and for there, good reason, there, by the
I
way.
I think that is a part of it, and that is why I think Howdy, while screwing up the Cincinnati Red stats, was, I think, a pretty astute. This is a legitimate conversation now, and if Russell Wilson puts together another 5 or 6 years and more playoff runs and continues to carry this thing, and my goodness, if you know can get this team back to another Super Bowl in a very difficult division and a very difficult conference with a head coach that, you know, he may have to have a new head coach, just because of the age and stage of where Pete's at over the next 5 to 6 years. If he can do that, then we have a, you know, I think a turn right, a Pete Carroll turn. And then I'll tip you the cap and say, yes, Russell is the greatest athlete to have ever performed in this city. But as of today, as we sit here in 2020, and maybe it is part of my youth, and maybe it was emulating that swing in the backyard on 9th Street in Puyallup, as every youngster did. Maybe it was watching him, you know, jump into the wall like Spider-Man and hit back-to-back homers with his dad and have a smile for days and actually make this organization relevant after two decades of being the laughing stock. Maybe there is a bias to all of that.
Russell Wilson did that too.
Oh, I think there was Russell and...
Yeah.
And
Russell and Pete.
And Marshawn.
Marshawn and Richard. They're all going to get
it. And Earl. And Legion of Boom. And the D-line.
Yeah, but that team with Russell Wilson as quarterback was the first one to put Seattle, the Seahawks, on the map.
No, they went to the Super Bowl in 2005. Yeah. Mike Holmgren made a bunch.
I'm going to stick by my statement.
Mike Holmgren made a bunch of playoff runs.
They were the first to put the Seahawks on the map. From an outside perspective, and in this case, Brock, I think I can speak quite confidently. Seriously.
I'm with Salk on that. The Legion of Boom made Seattle cool for the first time.
The Mike Holmgren Seahawks were not important.
Sean Alexander was
nationally,
wearing elbow pads.
Nationally, they were not important. It's not to say they weren't good. They made the Super Bowl, and by all accounts, should have won it. But they were not an important part of the national conversation.
About no, they did not resonate nationally.
Not
no,
even
no, no.
close.
No, and part of that's built on an O-line and the best left tackle arguably to ever play, an MVP running back, yes, Pro Bowl quarterback.
Hideous jerseys.
Really bad uniforms.
I mean, just so bad that I think it was hard for the rest of the country to accept them.
It's almost good that they lost that Super Bowl because you don't want that
a lasting
image
of those
all
awful
over
uniforms.
The facility. Ugh.
It's sad that they wore those uniforms. Right. Well, in comparison to what they wore before and after them, which are two great
Fantastic.
Uniforms. I mean, the old school are amazing, obviously. Yes. The John L. Williams and, that Steve Largent, those are amazing.
I like that you go John L. Williams.
Yeah,
Credit
why wouldn't
that
I?
Respect.
First Seattle Seahawk of my lifetime that I remember, I think. Well, it's probably
You love the big backs. Always have.
Brock, did
Always
you get well. Stuck wearing those new uniforms? You wear those in 2004?
Ooh, I don't think – I never really played
Because when
in
2004. You got to UW, you had to wear the purple, then you got to Seattle. Like, were you the reason that I was ushering in all these
No, 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 no.
Uniforms?
I got to wear the good old silver helmet, silver pants.
You did in the beginning. I didn't know when
I
you got
love
back
those.
From
it. At the end, didn't you have to wear the what do
the
you
metal?
Even call that?
Had I suited up in 2004 and not been on injured reserve, I probably – yeah, I would have had to have worn those.
Well, you know, what do you mean suited up? I mean, I read an article recently that told me very specifically that you went on to star in the NFL.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the late 90s, early 2000s.
That's when you were starring in the
NFL? I mean, fifth highest rated left-handed passer in the history of the league. I mean, if we want to talk about that.
Talk stardom, then you can check that.
All right. Good stuff. Let me talk about our friends at Ascend Prime here for a moment, Brock, because they are back open. They're back with us, which is great. We're really excited to have them back here on the podcast. But they are open. Ascend Prime in Bellevue. You and I have been there. It's ridiculous.
We have the Kobe burger?
We had some of the sushi. The place is absurd. The views are crazy looking back towards Seattle. And then if you go upstairs or outside, they get the whole 360-degree view. Limited capacity, obviously, with what's going on here in King County. But they do have reservations for the dining room and the lounge, plus some walk-in subject to availability. They're going to be open Tuesday to Saturday from 3 p.m. happy hour until 10 o'clock close. So anyone who wants to come in, you can come in. If you want to stay home, you can still order Ascend at home. They have pickup 7 days a week, which is great. Excuse me. And they've done essentially everything that a restaurant needs to do right now to make safety and service a top priority. So tables are spread out. They're at least 6 feet apart. They're only taking parties up to 5 people. They have hand sanitizer stations throughout the restaurant, masks on all the employees. And guests, of course, are encouraged to wear masks when they're not at the table as well. So have you been to a restaurant yet since the reopening?
Yes.
It was weird. Heather and I went Friday night, and you're just like, oh, all right. Like, it was nice having somebody else cook the food and then clean it afterwards. Like, that was awesome. That was pretty great.
And who are you?
Oh,
in order?
And you're here.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I just have to tell you what I want, and I don't have to make it myself?
Green
yeah,
water?
That sounds great.
Wow.
They got new menu items. They've got sushi tacos now, Brock. They've got crab grilled cheese. Yeah, so there's...
That's for you, Howdy.
They have Wagyu Bao Buns. There's some stuff going on at Ascend. And, of course, they even have bears enjoying cocktails set up around the restaurant.
So, bears?
Yeah, they have bears.
Come again?
There's bears. They're helping to promote social distancing and bring in a little levity to the space. So go to Ascend Prime, our good friends at Ascend. So, I, you know, one of the nice things about working from home most days, Brock, is that, you know, I was able to watch Talladega on Monday, which I will admit is not something I've done recently. I used to watch, truth be told, I used to watch a lot of NASCAR.
What age was that?
It was in my 20s, probably, like late 20s, early 30s, like right around the time I moved here. So, yeah.
Did not grow up watching?
No, of course not. No.
Okay.
Didn't grow up watching NASCAR, but my dad got into it, and so I kind of got into it, and I was super lucky. The first race I ever watched, I was like, all right, I'll root for that car. And I started rooting for the 48 car, Jimmy Johnson, who didn't win that race, hadn't won anything. And, like, his story actually was of the guy who kept coming close but didn't win. He went on to, of course, win, what, the next five championships in a row, won seven in his career, and is as decorated as any driver in NASCAR history.
You know
winners,
Salk.
Yeah, I just
got
lucky on that one, I'll tell you that. But I used to watch a lot of NASCAR, and it's sort of fallen off for me in the last few years a lot as I kind of only have room for one boring sport in my life. And I've chosen golf. Well, yeah, I've chosen golf over NASCAR. Like, I already have baseball, so I really only have room for one more boring sport in my life. And so I've chosen golf and had to ditch NASCAR.
That's a good trade.
I say that with love. You've chosen golf,
yeah, but hold on a second. You've not just chosen the PGA. You've chosen the LPGA, the Champions Tour.
What's the other one? The Corn.
Yeah, well, believe me, when it was NASCAR, I didn't just watch the NASCAR on Sunday, a Sprint Cup series at the time. You watch on Saturdays and maybe truck racing on Friday night. I mean, you know, when you get into these tours, Brock, you get into golf and NASCAR, they're kind of a good trade for one another, and they're both unbelievable to
nap to. Yeah, I don't see you watching, like, PCL baseball or...
No. Baseball is the highest level. Baseball's at the highest level only. Same with the NFL. Like, at football at the highest level only.
Yeah, you're never an AAF guy.
Not even really a college football guy. Like, yeah. Give it to me at the highest level.
It's gotta be the number of players things. There's a lot of players in those two sports.
Too many to learn.
One.
Way too many to learn.
But on the racetrack, I got 40 guys here. I'll take another set of races. There's 40 guys here.
It's only like 80 guys you got to learn.
Yeah,
perfect. And for the most part, the guys on Sundays race on Saturdays now. So really, you only got to learn like 50 people and you're right there. And with golf, I don't know. I now seem to know about 200 golfers. I'm sort of
quite a few people.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys there. Anyway, it was good to watch on Monday. And I will say that the image of all of the crews from all of the cars standing together behind Bubba Wallace was just amazing. It really was. And you know, I can at times sort of feel, I don't know, what's the word for it?
Schmaltzy?
Yeah, like that stuff can be schmaltzy and I just can't engage in it the way I'm probably supposed to. But not on this one, man. I thought it was remarkable. Maybe it helped that I had the sound off. I was on a conference call and I saw it and I was like, oh my God, I actually turned around my computer to show the person I was talking to what was happening on the screen because it was pretty remarkable seeing all of those guys and really all of their color uniforms and stuff and all the pit crews all coming to the support of one guy who had just witnessed an incredibly heinous act just a day earlier.
Captivating. And as you know, I like schmaltzy. Schmaltzy was my middle name. I think you gave that to me year two of our partnership here. So I'm all into that. But that was beyond. I mean, that doesn't even do it service. It was powerful, mm-hmm. right? And especially in these times that we are living in right now, with so much hatred and divisiveness and everything everywhere. And to see that whole crew to come together, and weren't they pushing the car? Right, I think they had.
I mean, not everybody at once, but the idea is you push the car out to where it's got to go, and they all did it together, so to speak.
Yes, and to see all of the different colors and all of the different teams and all of the different groups come together, and that thing, man, and I'm experienced it a couple of years ago. Remember when I was down in Arizona?
Oh yeah,
I got to go to the event and watch those guys race and be inside and be in the pit, and my old colleague Shannon Spake was kind enough to show us around, introduce us to a bunch of people and other friends that Cole Hamels, the baseball pitcher, is friends of mine, and got to meet him, and he knew a bunch of the drivers, and that thing is competitive, man. They're all in it. They all travel every weekend. It is arduous, like, you know, 50 weekends a year or 45 weekends a year, something just crazy that those guys work. And so it is hyper competitive, and to see them all come together in that manner was just beautiful, absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and then followed by the hugging that took place, and I saw Jimmy Johnson and a few of the other drivers come over to hug him. It was, I thought it was a really important moment for NASCAR, and seeing Richard Petty, the king, who is, he's the owner of that team now. He hadn't been out since the quarantine started. I mean, he's an older guy, and his quote saying essentially that this was more important for him to go out and show the support and hug his driver. I don't know, all of those things I found incredibly meaningful and interesting to watch. And yeah, there is an element of it happening in this sport that carries even, I mean, this is the sport of the South, right? I mean, it is the most regional of all sports in terms of the love they have for it across the South. I mean, I guess that and college football. And to see NASCAR go after the Confederate flags, to support Bubba Wallace the way they have, and then to see the noose, and then for him to come back, and do you see afterwards where he said he wasn't going to wear his mask afterwards because he didn't want anyone to miss his smile, that they couldn't take his smile. I mean, wow. those are just incredibly powerful thoughts, images, and I don't know, it just kind of, is this a different time for athletes than ever before?
It feels as if, Mike, their platform is, and there's always been a platform, right? I mean, that's just, you know, 30 years ago when I was in college, I remember speaking to some of that and feeling like, man, I've got a platform, an opportunity, and I want to really use it for good and use it to share, in my case, to share my faith, and knew that there was a platform. And I think athletes have always had a platform, but this one feels more personal.
Yeah. Well, and they have the ability to reach more people because of the interest in sports, not to mention the social media, the way it's covered, et cetera. I mean, Muhammad Ali obviously is the guy you point to as having an enormous social influence in his time. But I wonder, and I wasn't there, so I don't know, I wonder whether some of that is aided by him really being one of the only athletes to try to push a social agenda during that time.
Mm.
I don't know. Maybe there are others that I'm not thinking about. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but he certainly stands out as being somebody that was, you know, for whom that was incredibly important. Now, I think you have athletes across all the sports that all have direct contact with their fans and with people, and not to mention 24-hour ESPN and all the other networks and all of the sports radio stations around the country. I mean, when an athlete decides that they want to be a part of this conversation, it's everywhere.
Yeah, and I guess that's probably the word right there is, do they decide to be a part of it, right? Probably the greatest superstar, not probably, the biggest superstar that I was ever around, Peyton Manning, was one that was pretty protective of his kind of bubble around him, and rightfully so. Everybody wanted a piece of him, right? Everybody wanted, you know, to get inside and get inside that bubble and be on his team and get close to him, with as many of these superstars do.
And that's the Michael Jordan model of superstardom, right?
Yes. Yeah, I want to keep a hedge of protection around me and just have, you know, some that I really trust, but I can't have a million people coming at me and all wanting a part of me and share everything
and not jumping into social issues or political issues or anything else, and just saying, no, I'm here to play sports. Essentially, that's what I do.
Yep. Is that changing? Will we see in the next, you know, 3 to 5 to 10 years, more and more athletes say, no, bring it on. I want to take it, because, you know, it is double-edged. We talk about this all the time. You put yourself out there, there is going to be, you know, more pressure on you. There's going to be more attention. There's going to be more people coming at you. There's going to be people that disagree with you.
Yep.
And are you willing to, you know, get in that ring of disagreement and go back and forth and take the arrows that are going to come?
Well, if that generation, Brock, grew up, you know, the Peyton Mannings were watching Michael Jordan for cues as to how to become a superstar, this next generation is watching LeBron James.
Yeah.
And I think what they're seeing is and perhaps Colin Kaepernick and others, they're seeing a completely different model for how to be a superstar in America in the 2020s. So, yeah, my guess is you are going to see more and more of this. And the folks that are uncomfortable with athletes talking about their political views or their social views, depending on how you look at it,
mm-hmm.
my guess is you're going to see more and more of it, don't you think?
I think so. Are you going to see it on what level and what depth and what, you know, are guys willing to take on? How much energy are they willing to take on, you know, with that and what comes with it? You know, Colin Kaepernick obviously cost him in many ways his career. Mm-hmm. Are players going to be willing to deal with that and do that and stand up for that? It, you know, what counting the cost, you know, what am I willing to count the cost here to stand up for what I believe? And then how much time and energy, you know, can I, expend on that on top of trying to be the greatest athlete I can be to have the greatest career I can have, to have the larger platform to make even more of that impact with it? I think those are all things that certainly players of this generation are going to weigh much more than the players of a decade or two.
How much impact can they have? And I ask that because I clicked on, I follow Jimmy Johnson on Twitter, as I say. It's my favorite driver. It's my guy, the 48 low Chevy.
I had that moment yesterday. I had to choose the number four, Kevin Harvick, and Busch Light.
And Harvick completely spun Jimmy at the end.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
really obnoxious.
How do you do that, Kyle? I mean, you grew up at the International Speedway down there. You and Pops took your race cars from Olympia.
What I did was I watched all the cars go by, and I said, was that a Busch Light car? And I said, wow, that's my guy. Who is that?
At that time, they were all Busch Light cars.
Yeah, and then I said, oh, Kevin Harvick in the number four Busch Light Ford. There he is. Settle.
There you go.
Next.
I saw Jimmy tweet out some of his support for Bubba Wallace, and it was amazing seeing the first 10 replies. And I don't know what the algorithm is that puts what at the top, but they're all disagreeing with him and saying it's a hoax and this and that. And I'm not going to get into the details of whether it is or not. I don't know anything about it, but it made me wonder whether or not athletes like that who have large followings are able to convince people to change their minds, change their hearts or anything like that. And ultimately, what I think I land on is, for a huge segment of the population, no. Even if their favorite player, you know, chooses a stand that is opposite of theirs, they're either going to just ignore it or say, well, you're not my favorite player anymore, and I'm moving along. But I think that for the next generation, for the 10-year-old kid that is looking up to that athlete, that there probably is some level of role modeldom that is possible. And whereas for years you had the Charles Barkleys of the world and others saying, I'm not a role model to your kids, it's not my job. Yeah. You have a new generation saying, no, I'm going to be, and I'm going to try to use my platform to change the way those kids think.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you were kind of speaking through that, and I'm thinking, you know, more deeply on this as well, Mike, I think it then becomes, are you going to be the genuine article? Because if you're going to put yourself out there into some of these realms and these circles, both socially and politically, then do you really stand by it and really believe in that? And again, at what cost are you willing to stand up? You said, you know, can they change? Can they influence? Yes. You know, when the Drew Brees and Malcolm Jenkins incident occurred a couple of weeks ago, I think I said to you very clearly on this podcast, they will heal. They will get together. They will, and the only way it's going to happen is to spend the quality time. And so, you know, Malcolm can really feel what is in Drew Brees' heart, what he is truly all about, not a headline, not a media obligation, but what are you all about, you know? And I think that will be the absolute key for these players is I think there is an openness. I think there is a willingness. I think that this generation of both athlete and certainly this generation of young American right now wants to feel like they belong, mm-hmm. wants to connect. So you better be the genuine article if you're going to get in those circles. Because if you're going to do it for your own benefit,
you're going to get picked apart.
You're going to get destroyed.
Yeah.
Right. And you think, oh, I can do this, and you know this would be good for my career, and this is good for my PR, and this is good for my brand.
You got to believe that it's good for society, that it's truly what you want, and that it's something that you can bring to the world, and not just good for your career. You're 100% right.
Because if you don't,
you'll expose the phonies.
You will expose it, and you will probably be obliterated in ways that guys weren't. And again, that is why I think for those that are really willing to stand
and
do it.
And Brock, you'll do damage to the cause you're trying to help.
Yep.
I mean, you know, again, somebody brings up the Jesse Smollett hoax here. I mean, those are the things that do more damage than anything to the cause you are trying to commit to. So, yeah, if phonies decide they want to get into, you know, social activism while they're in sports and they don't know what they're talking about and they're not really committed to it and they're not really authentic about it, they'll end up doing more harm than good, not just to themselves, but to whatever it is they think they want to promote.
And go talk to different marketing managers over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years that manage, you know, athletes and their foundations and their events and their auctions and their benefits. And you know, if you were to interview 100 of them and say, what is it like, you know, working with X, Y, and Z in the pro athlete community? How did that go? The majority of them would say it's really hard. These guys are all over the place. They're scattered. They're pulled in a million directions. It's really hard to get them dialed in. There are certainly some that love it, that believe in it, that pour all their energy and resources in it and do it. And those are usually the ones that sustain. And I think of the Detlef Shrimp Foundation for decade and decade in this community, right? But a lot of them kind of come in and out for a reason because, oh, that was kind of cool and I want to do it. But are you really doing the work? Are you really going to invest the time? Are you truly going to volunteer? Are you going to do something when there's nothing in it for you? And most of the pro athletes that I have been around, both as a player, Mike, and then, you know, covering them over the last couple decades, if there's nothing in it for them and they're truly volunteering out of the goodness of their heart and they're truly giving back, you start to dwindle that field substantially.
Oh, I know that music. That's a music that signifies which is better, Brock. Which is better, when Brock Heward writes which is better questions or when Salk does?
I think when Salk does. I always feel a little funny writing them.
This is Salk's wheelhouse. This is made for him. He made it, and it's made for him.
Correct. Correct. I mean, it's really your deal.
A few weeks ago, though, I struggled just trying to... I think during this game, I said, you couldn't choose. Like, you can't choose, really. They're both great. It's not like you have to choose.
One thing that I'm not uncomfortable with, though, and I know it makes you very uncomfortable because you're like, how do you even do this, is I'm not uncomfortable texting my Which Is Betters, nor our show content.
It's horrifying to me how much you're able to write on your phone. It really kind of bothers. Like, so Heather and I had to respond to an email last night together to someone. I was like, all right, well, can we go downstairs so I can use my computer? It was only like 5 lines I had to write. But the idea of writing that out on my phone is anathema to me. Like, no chance. Which is better, writing on my computer or writing on my phone? The computer.
Well, Brock can send literal paragraphs.
It's crazy. I mean, when Brock one day writes the autobiography of his life, The Tale of the Hewards, it'll be typed out with his thumbs. Quite a tale.
Which is better, Brock's thumb typing on his phone or Mike's hunt and peck method with his fingers?
Well, all right, hold on a minute. I don't have a choice. Why you gotta take shots at my hunt and peck? I don't have a choice. I can't do the full thing with my left hand.
That's messed up, Howdy.
Well, but obviously, how else are you gonna do it? Hold on. You're telling me I'm supposed to do the nonstop thing like with my right hand?
Yeah.
But my left hand just does hunt and peck?
Yeah.
That would be so much harder. Mike. Some sort of a hybrid?
Yes.
Get out of here.
A hybrid.
Stop. No, I'm not doing
that. You've already taught yourself your own typing method.
You could create
a hybrid.
I'll tell you, in 1990, when I hurt my hand, computers were not nearly as important as they are today. That was not on the scope of the things that would end up being challenging.
That's not something you were trying to plan for. Like, I got to figure out a plan for this.
Yeah, that wasn't on the list. All right, Brock wrote most of these. Which is better? The Spieth roller coaster or the Brad Miller roller coaster?
In, right. Like, in total or just for me? Because for me, the Spieth roller coaster
is so much
better. Oh, you too with your saccharin just fawning over him for years and years, deeming him the next Tiger Woods, the heir apparent to the throne.
He's better than Tiger.
Very clearly, he is Jag. He is just another guy.
Well, hold on. He's not just a guy. I mean, he was number one in the world for a while.
For like 3 months. He's done. Toast.
You know what's funny? You guys will spend a lot of time kind of focusing on Jordan Spieth and his disappearance act because of how much Kyle and I like him and because he's such a good dude. Brock's boy is really the one who's fallen off.
Who?
Your boy, Jason Day.
He's like no longer even relevant.
What has happened to Jason Day?
It's vertigo. Got the vertigo.
It's just that.
You know, he still has vertigo.
Ellie was up all night dealing with some lower back pain.
I got to tell you, remember how we used to talk about how Jordan might get one day too big for golf because the face showed that like he might blow up a little bit, and that hasn't really happened.
No, that's fine.
Jason Day.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Bryson DeChambeau.
Well, no, DeChambeau's giant.
That's just his plan, is to be Ben Roethlisberger morphing into Jared Lorenz.
He's saying it's his plan. Like, yeah, that's my plan, too.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to get bigger.
Oh, this 45 pounds? Yeah, I planned that. Don't worry.
He's crushing the ball, though.
I mean, it's
plowing the ball.
When you go to Disneyland. Disneyland has Disneyland and California Adventure, right? And what's the name of the, what's the big roller coaster? Is it called California Adventure?
Lost these two. Sorry. I don't
California
know.
California Screamin'?
They didn't like my descriptions of
Brad California Screamin' is Jordan Spieth. Brad Miller never got to that level. Brad Miller was just another guy. So
that's
he
true.
Never, he's a little roller coaster. He is in the little kiddie
land. He's at Knott's Berry.
I really hope Jordan figures it out. It's so hard.
Hey, if you go to roller coasters, it's got to be Fernando Rodney. That's the ultimate roller coaster.
The Rodney experience. Yes.
True.
I want Jordan to win so bad.
Yes,
I'm watching him, and then if I'm not home, I'm on Twitter. I just pull up the Spieth tracker on Twitter, and I'm following it. It's so pathetic.
But it was fun. 2 weeks ago, he was in it on Sunday.
I know.
It was a reminder. I used to get to watch golf like I watch football. Like, come on, Jordan, come on. Let's go. And I lost that for a couple of years, and it was back. It was Sunday. I was standing up.
Oh, nice.
Like, come on. And then it was gone. Quick.
I was listening to
hole number one, Kyle.
Hole number one. Yeah. You know, he
didn't have it that day.
Just like you or I, he duffed a chip about 6 inches. You know, who among us has not been there?
I was listening to him interviewed after the first round here the other day, and they were like, "Oh, hey, back to the roller coaster, huh?" And it just dawns on me how much more honest solo athletes can be than team athletes. Mm-hmm. Because he was like, "Well, look, man, I didn't really see it as a roller coaster. Like, yeah, I know it kind of appeared that way, but I had a good shot on 7. It took a bad bounce and bounced off to the side, and then I got myself in a little trouble. So I wasn't playing bad, and then I had a good shot here, a good shot there. And, you know, look, last week it was the first time I'd been in contention on a Sunday in a couple of years, and so, yeah, maybe it got to me." Like, the honesty they're willing to give, both positive and negative, about how they play, you would never, ever hear that from, "Well, look, man, I put the ball in the right place, receiver ran the wrong route."
Yep.
Like, you won't hear that level of honesty, but you can from a solo athlete because he's not accountable to anybody else other than himself or herself.
Well, in Jordan's case, it's caddy that he yells at, too. I mean,
that's wrong, and you know it.
He did.
He goes after that.
Perfect
he yells
shot.
At. Now, one time
when the
Michael
caddy
Greller
screwed
put
it
him
up.
Over a cliff.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You did that to me. You did that to me.
I mean, clearly they're still together, so I don't think it broke them apart.
That was the turning point. I mean, really, Jordan's not been the same since he yelled that at him.
We've had this question before, but one last thing on golf. What is the most frustrating thing that you yourself can do on a golf course?
Miss a 2-foot putt.
I don't think it's that.
Oh.
It's miss a wide open fairway to me. I'm on the tee box. It is the widest, easiest fairway. It's a downhill lie. It's going to hit and roll. I'm going to get an extra 50 yards out of it. And I hit it in the rough, and it never moves because it gets in the rough. Yeah. That is the worst, most frustrating. There's only one thing I can do, and that's hit this ball as terrible as I can.
I got to say, I got two things that I've, and I can't decide which is more frustrating. I think I know the answer. It is either great drive. You're 130 yards out and you duff.
Drive of the day.
Right, and then you duff the next one and it goes like 8 yards. That one's really bad. But I think what's worse is the scold chip. You've hit a decent approach shot. You're 10 yards off the green. And all you got to do is like put a little, you know, up and down. You get a par. Or, okay, fine, you're going to get a bogey. And instead, it fires
it
off
goes.
Into the woods.
That's 35 yards past the hole.
Like,
I was 10 yards in.
I was right here. That is maddening. That will make me want to throw something, probably more than anything else on a golf course. All right, which is better? Medium rare Sitka King salmon off the grill or a medium rare ribeye off the grill?
Probably the salmon. It's a more unique experience. The ribeye is more commonly accessible, probably.
I'll take the ribeye every single time.
I'll take the ribeye, the tri-tip, the New York strip, the filet, the hanger steak, whatever steak it is other than like, you know.
Hanger steak.
Yes. Hanger steak's good.
It is not bad.
Hanger's great. Don't mess with
hanger. Are you going to go tell me you're going to get the rancher next?
Dude, I'm telling you, hanger steak's good. The Denver steak. pretty good cut. I'll take all of them over this. And I like the salmon.
Oh, that's fine.
But it's not close.
Okay, good. You answered the question. Then I won't bring you a piece of the 28-pound
Okay, well, I'll take both of their shares.
Either you go all the way my way or you get nothing.
Yep.
All right.
What do you like? A really unique experience, custom tailored to your taste buds, or do you like some really generic thing you could get at any Texas Roadhouse?
Let me be clear.
Outside of Scottsdale.
What do I like? Something that I can capably cook on my own grill, or something I'm almost definitely going to overcook and then won't taste good?
So, as I said in the question,
the amount of leeway you have to not overcook salmon is like 12 seconds.
Hey, Kyle.
And then it's gone.
Kyle, where do you want me to meet you today? I'll bring you this beautiful piece of fish.
Let's go meet down at the Fall City Roadhouse. I can maybe come down 202. We'll meet near Aldera somewhere.
Okay, great.
Now, if there's halibut, maybe we'll have a different conversation.
Okay.
Which is better? The amount of time and love and care that Howdy spends on his yard and his retaining wall, or the amount of time, love, and care that Kyle spends on his camper?
Oh, putting some work in yesterday.
Yeah, I'm going with Kyle because he's going to keep that long term and it's going to be nice. My yard will be a disaster in a year. Like, it won't be kept up anymore.
You'll have done all that work for nothing.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
It's built for life, Howdy.
Yeah,
you're like
that'll
Chris
start
Peterson.
Sliding down the hill and that won't be standing anymore. Yeah, absolutely. Kyle's just definitely.
Big work. We're going, getting ready. Summer's coming. Things are opening up. The campgrounds are opening. We're de-winterizing.
Yeah. Do you enjoy that, Kyle? When I called you a couple weeks ago to see if you could golf, and it was rather last minute, and you had obviously made your plans, and you were going to spend, I think, that Sunday afternoon.
Sunday. It was a trailer day.
Yeah. Do you enjoy trailer day?
I love trailer because it's an investment. You know, I'm ready. I'm in my driveway. I'm getting ready, and I'm picturing like, man, I'm going to be at Crescent Bar in 3 weeks. I'm going to be extending this awning. I'm pressure washing the awning. I'm going to be getting it ready.
You sound like Walton.
Oh, I'm riding my bike from Quincy to the Rock City Dam saying, I'm going to get this guy. Let's go.
Let's go.
And if you enjoy that at 30, what are you going to be like at 40 or 50?
He's just going to be, he'll have moved into
his
camper
there.
By that point.
Chris Pendle.
It'll just be a double wide trailer somewhere. And I'll be like, wow, isn't this nice? Solar panels.
Which is better, a great Rainier cherry or a great Honeycrisp apple? I'll take that cherry, man. Now, look, let's be clear. Neither one of them are going to come close to the local peach or the local nectarine. But cherry's going to beat the apple.
On where are we at in the fruit season?
Taste. Cherry season.
I purposely put this question in because I really wanted to hear the latest with Sazio's. And can you kind of map out, what are we, late June? Can you kind of map out here what's coming?
We're entering the height of cherry season for local cherries. We're just getting some of the big ones. The giant marble-sized ones, like those are going to come. Like the Smasher marbles, those are going to come. Like, we're weeks away from that.
And Smasher marbles?
You ever seen, you know, there's like two kinds of marbles, right? There's like the little tiny ones, and then there's like the really big ones.
Yeah.
Like the really big size ones.
Oh, the Smasher marbles. Yeah. Got it. Okay.
So that's what's coming up next, and it'll be here in a week or two.
Okay.
When is peach season?
And then
still
peach
a couple
season
weeks.
Starts mid-July.
Right. We have to first finish getting through winter here so that we can get to summer.
Of course. Yeah, right. So that'll be July 5th.
When does winter end?
It doesn't end.
It seems that way. This is an eternal winter this year, at least on the weekends.
What will Saturday and Sunday be like this week? Nice, right?
It's going to be like
56 and raining on.
No.
What is the deal?
No.
It leads to my next question. Which is better, June or February? Trick question. They're both horrendous.
Are we done here?
June and February. 2 months to live in Arizona.
Are you done?
I think so. Am I? Am I done? I think I'm done.
I think you sound.
Are we done here? I think we're probably done. This is good. This is another fun podcast, Brock. Thank you. Thanks again to our friends at Ascend Prime. We'll be back with you guys next week. Until then, hey.
See you in tomorrow, Martin.
See you, everybody.
Get to the chopper!